friends, welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
And we're here with someone so exciting that I feel like we've talked about so much over the many years but has never appeared on the pod. We are joined today by...
It me, Erin Kelly.
The actual Erin Kelly. And we love it when a guest not only knows to say it me, blah, 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 but has explicitly said, can I say it me?
Erin Kelly. That's the best bit over now. I can leave.
Any peaked pod. Yeah, pod is over. Pod is done. Thank you so much for joining us. We're very happy to have you here.
Thank you.
I know you're not loving life right now. You're not feeling like peak Erin.
I'm a bit tail end COVID-y, yeah. So the brain is not, the synapses aren't connecting as quickly as they should, but I think I can, I can still string a sentence together.
Yes,
but
we'll find out where we are. God willing. Okay, so... in honour of your synapses not firing, we're going to get Alice to nutshell your book.
Nice. So, we're here to talk about Erin's new book, which is called The Skeleton Key, which is out on the 1st of September. And I'm going to try and nutshell it, but it's quite a tricky one to nutshell because it covers many decades. But basically, it's a psychological gothic thriller that opens with the exhuming of some treasure to mark the end of a decades-long treasure hunt. Except what they find is human remains. Is that a good nutshell?
Yes, and like you say, it is a really difficult one. I need to work on my own pitch. It's probably the most intricate book I've ever written, in that there is a concept, there is a book within a book, there is a song within a book within a book, and there is also a treasure hunt that needs clues. So I really enjoyed writing it, and I think it's one of those books that once you get into it, hopefully there's a lot of meat there for the reader. But in terms of the elevator pitch, it's a bloody nightmare. Like, I've really shot myself in the foot with this one. Yeah.
I can see that. Because, yeah, it is. It's meaty as hell.
Yeah.
It's and a lot of people have a lot of their own motivation. Like, it's not a simple book in terms of motivations and plot and what is obvious to the reader throughout.
Yeah, there's a lot of misdirection in there, and there's more than one viewpoint. And... writing this book, I had the same challenge that I've had with every single one of my books, only more so. So I always really struggle in the first draft to hit the ground running with. So I write psychological thrillers. I don't write the kind of crime where you start with, you know, this sort of chalk outline on the body and then in comes somebody. I'm much more likely to write a book that leads up to a death than begins with one. And that makes it difficult. What you've got to do then is you've got to do a lot of world building, you've got to establish menace, and you've got to establish the idea that there will be a death or that there has been a death. But equally, I want to bring readers into a completely different world every time that I write a book. So this time it's the world of armchair treasure hunts, which are essentially picture books full of clues that will lead to what can be a token or what can be literally a pot of treasure or can just be a pride, can be fame and glory. They take a million different forms. So I took a deep dive into that world. Beforehand, it was ballet with Watch Her Fall, and then I did eclipses and psychiatric hospitals through the years. So each time I'd like to delve into a world that I don't know much about, that I'm really mildly interested in, and then become obsessed with it. And then the challenge is to bring the reader into that world, let them know that you are being taken somewhere, because that's what I love about a book. I mean, there are lots of really solid psychological thrillers where the selling point is relatability, that the setting is, so something like The Girl on the Train, what that did was translate universally, because wherever you are, you've been on a train and you've looked through a window. So probably not with complete commercial savvy, I tend to do the opposite. So hopefully you will find something relatable in there as a reader as to what the characters are going through, but I like to put you in a world that you might not necessarily know much about. And I really love it when William Boyd and P.D. James do that very well. They will always write a book where nothing, you know, William Boyd's done sort of guerrilla conservation and loss adjusting for insurance companies. Two really very different worlds, but everything about the plot depended on those. And P.D. James used to do that, you know, it would be a publishing house or a newspaper or a closed order of nuns or something. And that really appeals to me, that sense of creating a spooky, weird world.
So this is one of the questions I wanted to ask you, actually, was what comes first for you? Like, the kind of theme, like the broad theme, Or, because also your books always have at their heart like a real emotional connection, whether it's a rivalry or an unrequited love or some kind of emotional spark that will then gear the actual kind of nuts and bolts plot and move that forward. So what comes first? Do you have the idea for the scenario or do you have the world?
Yeah, it's a scenario rather than anything else. So for The Skeleton Key, I had the OG Armchair Treasure Hunt picture book, which is called Masquerade. It was written in the 70s by an artist called Kit Williams. And obviously this was in a pre-internet time where there were only three channels and the pubs shut in the afternoon. So people had nothing better to do than to pore over these really beautiful picture book clues with hidden letters and mathematical equations that led up to an anagram that itself became an acrostic that led to the burial of something underneath the shadow of a statue that only hit on the equinox. What was the question? Oh yes, scenarios. And for a long time that had been ticking over, and I knew that people had been completely obsessed. So Masquerade was actually cited in the British divorce courts because one man became so obsessed that his wife just said, I've got to leave because all you ever talk about is this book and I can't stand it anymore. And so I knew that it was quite folky. I like a bit of folk horror as well. So it kind of tapped into that sort of, you know, ye olde English rambling hills with chalk men with giant dicks and stuff like that. I love a bit of that. And I also knew that obsession, which is my obsession is obsession, could be part of it. And I thought for a long time that there was something in that. And like all my other books, it stopped being something vague and became something very solid with a scene. And the scene, it actually does appear now halfway, well, I say about a quarter or a third into the book, was the idea of somebody looking for buried treasure, looking for that last piece of the puzzle, and instead unearthing human remains. And that was the scene, and that's how they always begin. And so I thought, well, now I didn't know who had found it, I just kind of heard the screams and knew it would be somewhere in the natural environment. And I will often piece together what the book needs depending on that. So I thought, well, somebody needs to find the treasure. Who's going to find the treasure? The artist, because it's an old treasure hunt, the artist needs to be sort of my parents' generation, you know, sort of boomer who hit every lucky branch on the way down, because a lot of it is about boomer privilege. And I'm going to make him a man so that he can be super, super privileged. I knew I didn't want to write from his voice. I knew I wanted to write from somebody my own age. So I am 46, and a lot of the book is... Now, here come the themes, which is something that always turns up at the end of the first draft and introduces itself to me. But I thought, well, I'll just write... You know, I very often write from women broadly my own age just because I know exactly where the references are and I know exactly what the flashpoints are. But with Nell, I wanted to write somebody who was just on the cusp of that kind of midlife invisibility. And The Skeleton Key is about female youth and beauty and a certain kind of very narrow objectified beauty. And Nell has a stepdaughter who is blossoming into life and sexuality just as her body clock goes to shit, and she is potentially, you know, if you're not careful, you can find yourself written off. But she's also finding that invisibility useful because it's something she's wanted her whole life, because she has come under a lot of unwelcome scrutiny because of the book. So yeah, the themes, it will happen in layers, but the themes always emerge at the end, and there's always some vaguely feminist drum banging going on, but hopefully it's the story is a bit of a Trojan horse for that. And I do have to be careful, actually. I think something changed when I wrote He Said, She Said, which was about a rape and the ensuing court case, and I had to be really careful that I wasn't writing an op-ed for The Guardian, and that I was telling a story where the themes were there if you wanted to look for them,
but not like a morality play.
But it's so tempting. It's so tempting when just the world's full of trash bags. So that's another thing I have to really discipline myself to do.
So I wanted to just mention, I wanted to touch on, you're just talking about the kind of feminist theme of the book. But there is this also very masculine rivalry throughout. When in the process did you develop that relationship? The two patriarchs of these, like, how do you even describe them? Families that are connected by marriage, by time. How did you come up with this rivalry? Was that always part of it?
Honestly, I can't remember because I started it 2 years ago. But Frank is the artist, the author of the treasure hunt book, The Golden Bones, that the whole country got obsessed with, and it engendered stalkers and unexpected death and children without parents and all sorts of juicy stuff. I think I wanted to just explore that kind of male rivalry because I really did get a sense that I was writing about men. And it was more interesting to me to pit them against each other, I think, than it was to show them just through the attitudes to their women. So in the book, in the present day, we have Frank and his art school best friend, Lal, who have bought houses together, their children have married each other, their wives are best friends, so they are almost like a sort of four-parent family, a very blended family. And it is, I wanted to write about it, it's almost a sibling relationship. And I read a lot of books about art and rivalry. So Francis Bacon and Lucian Freud and Van Gogh and Gauguin, you know, all of these men who sort of defined each other by their work. And there's a lot of willy waving involved, even if it's not literal. Sometimes it is literal. And I don't think women, certainly very few women artists of that generation, so I'm talking sort of born in the 40s, early 50s, really got to play out rivalry in that way because there weren't enough women making art at that level for there to, you know, if you were the female artist, you would be in a category of your own or you would be othered. And I thought, really, for that to work, I'm going to need two guys. So I think that's what it came to be. But honestly, I can't remember the origin of that. I just remember as soon as I wrote Frank, rather, the main artist, his best friend Lal, was there as well.
So if you started writing this 2 years ago, is this your first lockdown writing experience?
No, it's my first post-lockdown writing experience. So I wrote Watch Her Fall during lockdown, which is why it's so mental. and I think I had the germ of the idea for The Skeleton Key as Watch Her Fall was being completed. And I'm really lucky in that sort of two-thirds of the way through any book, a new idea has always come and slightly started whispering itself to me. And actually, in the real depths of lockdown, when I was probably postnatal depression from my second daughter who was born in 2013, but lockdown brought all that to a head. And I got better during lockdown, which was great. But before I got better, I wanted to abandon Watch Her Fall and start writing this one. So it had a really long gestation period, which meant that it was... So the longer you can cook a book, I find, the more fun it is to write, because the helpful part of your brain is sort of ticking away in the background and you start sort of magpieing around for books and films that otherwise would have passed you by. So this book was a real joy to write. Firstly, because my children were at school, and I mean, it was stressful in that I still haven't or hadn't quite caught up from just the financial implications of lockdown, because Watch Her Fall was late and that delayed publication. So The Skeleton Key should have been out at the beginning of this year, and that's just... So that was, you know, there was a real impetus to get it finished. But actually, it's the first book I've ever written on antidepressants. And I put off getting help for so long because I heard all these stories about how, oh, it will drown the muse. And actually, what it did was drown the bonkers part that itself was drowning the muse. So, I wish I'd got help much earlier. But it was just a joy, because lockdown was over and things were going back to normal, and I was able to do boots on the ground research rather than just look at Instagram ballerinas, which is all I did for Watch Her Fall. So yeah, it was a real sort of hurrah, we're all alive and I'm working again. And I absolutely loved writing this book, and I got to go and live on a barge for 4 days.
Yeah, because that's what we wanted to...
This is going to be a question.
We wanted to ask about like research, because obviously, you know, if you set each of your books in kind of different worlds, how do you go at researching those worlds? Obviously, Watch Her Fall doesn't count because you have to do it all over Instagram, but like, so, you know, for this, we've got like living on a barge, we've got like stained glass, we've got kind of folk culture, you know, kind of folk art and, you know, English folk song culture.
Okay, so the boat, so Nell, my narrator, lives on a boat, and that's partly because she was, as a young woman, a victim of one of the hunters who sort of blurred the line between reality and the hunt and the story behind the hunt. And that is partly because I just thought it was a good metaphor for her always keeping on the move and never wanting to settle down, but also because I've always been fascinated about people who live on a boat, because I'm so uptight. I can't even camp at a festival. I just can't. I don't understand why you would, if you could have a flushing toilet and hot water and underfloor heating, I don't know why you wouldn't have all those things and why you would choose to do it. But equally, I'm really romantic and I love the notion of it. I Airbnb'd my way onto a little boat on the Grand Union Canal and stayed there. And it was beautiful, actually. It was a really lovely way to live. And you couldn't do it with a family my size, and you couldn't do it if you were very elderly, and you couldn't do it if you had any physical disability. It's an increasingly popular lifestyle choice because property is impossible to buy in London. So this is a way, you know, you can buy a boat for 50 grand. And then all you've got. And then you've got your mooring fee, which, if you don't mind constantly picking up and moving again, you know, it is an affordable way to live in London, and lots of really young, interesting people are choosing it. I thought it was beautiful until day three, when the chemical toilet got full up, and then it was just
less beautiful.
very much not for me. So that was fun. The stained glass, I had help from your good friend, Emily Hatzar, who... she just told me really interesting things, like she's only got fingerprints left on one finger.
Yes.
Because she's just sliced.
Yeah.
And she told me that really late into the process as well. And I was thinking, oh my God, this is a gift. Like, I tried so hard to, you know, this kind of master criminal with only one fingerprint. And then while I was trying to think of a little subplot that I could use, that I was like, no, this isn't good. Actually, what you've got is somebody with the most identifiable fingerprints in London, because they're covered in glass slashes.
Yeah.
So instantly, but she just told me, you know, she was giving me ideas about, I said, could you run this business out of a boat, you know? And she said, well, if you only buy the pieces you need, and if you never go too far from a supplier, yeah, you could just about do it. And she was... because I think she works out of a shed, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. Tiny little shed.
Yeah, so she said, yeah, you could do it. It wouldn't be ideal. And if you wanted to make a window, for example, you would have to rent a space, or you'd have to move somewhere different. And then that became something that unfolds in Nell later. She has to, you know, there's a lot about her own ambition that's been repressed because she doesn't want to be in her parents' shadow. So that was something that fed in. The folky stuff was all in my head already, because... I'm the daughter of a pair of old 70s hippies, and so most of my favourite songs were written around about the time that I was born, in the 70s. So, and the same with folk art. I used to be really into kind of engravings and illuminated manuscripts, and so I've got, that was already in me, actually, and that just fed in. That was just a case of refreshing my memory.
It was such a blast from the past to read the word Cecil Sharp House, because I think when I was at UCL, that was one of the exam venues.
Oh, really?
So I'd have to go to Cecil Sharp House in Camden for, can't remember, some French literature exam.
I think I did a folk dancing exam there when I was about 12. And I've been to quite a few gigs there, and I've been to a wedding there, and I edited a lot of the book there. It's a really weird space. It looks like a school hall.
Yes.
And it's sort of got this sort of early 20th century look, and it looks like it should be a chapel in a Welsh mining village or something, but it's not. It's in the middle, you know, it's just round the back of Primrose Hill, and between Primrose Hill and Camden Market. It's the weirdest place, but it's also a really wonderful place to work, because you know, if you go there 3 days straight, one day you'll have a troupe of Bollywood dancers rehearsing, and then the next you'll have two people marking out a fencing scene, and then the next time there'll be, you know, somebody getting married in the same room. I would obviously get out of the way if someone was getting married. I wouldn't inflict my little writing gloves and my scritch scratching in the corner, I don't think.
So you mentioned before we hit record,
mm.
we did some pre-pod chat, and you mentioned that the opening chapter changed. I'd love to hear about that on record.
Okay, so the opening chapter, which was the bit where the treasure is found and it turns out to be a bone instead, was for a long time the beginning of the book, I don't think I've ever written an opening chapter. I don't think I've ever written a first scene, rather, that stayed being the first scene, because with every single book, the scene is the germ of the novel. Sometimes it's even the midpoint. So when I wrote The Poison Tree, my debut, that was inspired by me going to see a friend from university for a summer party. And I didn't know how posh she was, basically. I didn't know that she'd grown up in just insane privilege because she'd seemed all right at university. And me and another friend went to ring the doorbell on her block of flats and then realised she lived in all of it. That was her family home. And that's a scene that is quite deep in The Poison Tree, but just that thing of thinking you know someone and then you're plunged into a completely different, much more glamorous world. And with The Skeleton Key, I couldn't have started with this because there are too many unanswered questions. There's too much action. There's too many people. So it's an extended family and there's also a film crew there. And it would have been quite schlocky, and it would have then... It can be tempting to sort of start with a bomb and then work your way backwards. But actually, if I started by establishing the family situation and the house that they all grew up in and the stalking and the death threats and the actual nature of the puzzle itself, my hope was by the time we got to the revelation, we knew exactly what was at stake and, more to the point, who was at threat. So for the artists, their reputation is at threat. For Nell herself and her stepdaughter and her niece, who are all thought by certain treasure hunters to be incarnations of the woman in the book that the story is based on, there is a physical threat from the stalkers, especially one, you know, the niece is very young and looks just like the muse did at her age, and there's a lot of different concern. You know, her brother, Nell's brother, is now masterminding a new treasure hunt, something more digital, and his business is at stake, so hopefully caring about these people a bit more and understanding them means that after that the investigation can really move at a clip. But it is really difficult, and it is something I struggle with every single time, that balance between creating a world and creating characters that you care about and knowing. I think I have enough of a readership now, by the, you know, you do not pick up my book expecting a rom-com. You know that there's going to be blood on the walls at some point, but at the same time I try to write every book for somebody who's never read one of my books anymore, because it can be mistaken for quite, if I'm not careful, it can be mistaken for quite quiet literary fiction, and I want more readers than that.
Yeah, and you deserve them.
So, if you don't mind me jumping in again, but speaking of your previous books, your previous output, in some ways The Skeleton Key feels like a slight change in direction, because we're really digging into a slightly more gothic plot. Although, on reflection, We Know, You Know also has that kind of multi-generational gothic energy. Is that a direction you're going to stay in?
Yes, I think so. It definitely wasn't deliberate. It was something that... I didn't set out to write a different book this time, although I... And the first I knew of it was when people started saying, oh, you've gone in a slightly different direction here, haven't you? I think it's just a natural progression of... So I've got the... I feel very confident in my craft now, so I really think I know how to put a story together. And if I don't keep myself interested by, you know, sort of indulging things I like and find weird and interesting, then I'm going to get very bored, if storycraft is all there is. So these are the books these are the books I love to read. So I loved The 13th Tale, for example, and Her Fearful Symmetry, which was the second Audrey Niffenegg novel. And maybe, yeah, I really like Laura Purcell and Anna Mazzola, and I don't know if I've got historical fiction in me, although Stone Mothers did have a historical bent to it. But that, yeah, that does feel like the direction I'm going in, which is exciting for me. And I hope I've done it gradually enough that it doesn't... I mean, it's not a change in genre, that my books will always...
Oh, yeah.
..be...
psychological.
They'll always be suspense, yeah. I think. Whether, I mean, when I set out, I thought I was writing suspense in that quite old-fashioned way. So Barbara Vine, Patricia Highsmith, Du Maurier... because I think it was first published before the big psychological thriller renaissance, so there weren't really, unless you looked at Nikki French, there weren't all those reference points to start from. So it will always be suspenseful, yeah, but it might be getting a bit darker and weirder, a few more cobwebs and a bit more black lace maybe.
We love
music
it.
Music.
So you are now, as you said, very kind of comfortable and established in your craft as a writer.
Mm.
You also teach. I'm very interested. Whenever I like go to the hairdressers, I'm like, what is everyone getting right now? And if I get a tattoo, I'm like, what do people want right now? So from your point of view as someone who teaches, are there like tropes that people are really into? Is there way, like, techniques of storytelling that you see come up in a lot of your students writing? I don't know, I'm just so interested in what's going on in like a new generation.
Well, by definition, I do get a lot of psychological thrillers, just because that's what I skew towards. And also, I don't look at every kind of writing, so I don't look at I don't take on YA, and I don't take on speculative or sci-fi. Not because I don't respect the genres, it's I respect them hugely, but I'm not well read enough, and I stopped doing that when I took a student's work to an agent saying, this has blown my mind, I've never read anything like it, it's incredible. And I showed her the first page and she said, this is the Hunger Games.
Mm.
So I realised that there is, you know, there is somewhere that I should just not tiptoe. So I do get a lot of psych thrillers. I think I do still get people writing very solid, traditional police procedures and psych thrillers, and I'm not necessarily seeing a whole heap of innovation. I should say that I haven't actually taken on any clients for a year, just because it's as easy to burn out editing as it is writing. I thought when I started teaching that it would be a bit of a holiday and use a different part of my brain, but it doesn't. So post-lockdown, I just thought I needed to catch my breath. So I don't necessarily see a lot of innovation, but sometimes I don't think innovation is always important. I would rather read something solid done really well than a gimmick that doesn't quite fly. I'm not seeing, or when I stopped, I wasn't seeing as much high concept that tiptoed into speculative fiction as I was. So mysteries set where there was a specific, like, do you know John Mars, the author?
I know the name, but I haven't read.
Okay, so there was a time when I was getting sent a lot of substandard John Mars. Now, he does what he does brilliantly. So he will, it's quite sort of Aldous Huxley-ish, a world in which your relationship is monitored by tech companies, for example, a world in which an algorithm has been proven to find the one. There was a time when I was seeing a lot of what he does very well done very badly. And now it has come back to just solid, not always groundbreaking stuff. But then I'm probably not the best person to see for publishing trends, I guess, because I don't think I probably received that huge a broad spectrum.
I'm just nosy. Yeah. I just like knowing what people are up to.
I hadn't ever considered that before, so now I'm really interested, and I'm going to go away and think of all of the wonderful things that I've been sent and that I just forgot to mention, so I'll tweet them.
Yeah. You are right, though. I feel like, you know, a really strong elevator pitch can really make me turn my head, but the thing that will keep me turning pages is just a really believable world. Like, being in a story that is just so compelling, characters that I really believe, and I really felt with The Skeleton Key, the moment when I knew that I was in an Erin Kelly book, it was not just the amazing way that it kicked off, because it kicks off with some great drama, it's brilliant, but it's when I was in Frank's room, and, you know, in that when that first flashback, and it's so bohemian, and there's, like, incense, and I was like, I know where I am, I'm in an Erin Kelly novel.
Yeah, I can't resist a beaded curtain. And
love it.
And a candle in an old wine bottle. What can I say?
So we're now more than 75-80% of the way through the publication of The Skeleton Key. Does that mean that your new idea has presented itself?
Yeah, I'm about halfway through the new book.
Are you having a nice time?
I'm loving it. Yeah, I'm having such a nice time. There is an element of it that I will tell you when we stop recording that I can't tell you now. But it is essentially about a woman who runs a vintage clothing store, and she gets a job lot of dresses from somebody who may or may not be dead, and who may or may not be a murderer. And it's about things she finds in the pockets of these dresses, and the contents of an old handbag, and the things she finds out.
Do the noise.
I am vibrating.
I could sense it coming off you.
Yeah, and it's structured slightly differently to anything I've done before. So I'm going to do what I never did in the beginning of my career, and I'm going to share a really dirty draft with my editor. And I'm finding that I'm doing this at an earlier and earlier stage before, with every book, which I think it looks as though I need more of a crutch, but I think it's confidence. I think it's confidence in the, I mean, I've been really lucky with editors, I have to say. From day one, I have just always been blessed with people who are not only great publishers, but also have that kind of scalpel-like instinct for when a story isn't working, in very different ways, actually, and in very different, you know, some go in with broad strokes, others will kind of pick out the minutiae, and it's very interesting. But I used to think of it as a failure on my part not to deliver a perfect first draft. And now, much more pragmatically, I think, especially since I am still to an extent playing catch up after lockdown, because I've got two children, which meant that it was not the productive holiday for me, it was for some writers. I'm very happy and grateful to have those two children, but it's not compatible with, you know, pinging out a book a year, which I would like to get to, and that isn't going to happen if I take 6 months to polish text that ends up being put in the bin. So, I'm going to share a really rough draft, by which I mean possibly some chapters will even be laid out almost like a screenplay.
Wow.
With just some directions, just so that she can tell me, and my agent and my early readers can tell me, if I've got this thing I'm trying to do right. And increasingly, I don't feel like the book really exists until I'm getting feedback. It used to be a much lonelier process, but also a much more instinctive one. And I think as I go on, instinct is bolstered by craft, but what that means is more inspiration needs to come in. And actually, that might be another reason why I'm getting super gothic, because I need, you know, I get turned on by knowing stuff. I really love learning about things, and that's what it needs now. You know, just a character, just something like The Poison Tree, I couldn't write now. Just a girl in a house and a friendship and a love affair, I couldn't really do that now. I reread it recently, and there's so, compared to the books I write now, there's so little incident in that book. I'm still really fond of it, and it was very good to me, but if you actually extracted what happens and who does what, there is maybe one third of the stuff, the events, that you would find in The Skeleton Key. And I don't think one way of doing it is different or better, but I think that's just as a consequence of more outside stimulation feeding into every single book.
Because that was something that I wanted to know, is a lot of the authors that we talk to on the pod are debuts. So I was like, we've got a, you know, established writer who has written tons of books, many of, or most or all of which we've read between us, or, you know, individually. So what I was really interested in is how you perceive that your writing process, or like what your interest in writing about, has changed over the years. And I was like, oh, maybe she's going to be like, it hasn't. It's been the same since day one. But it's really interesting to know that you, like, even as the person with the brain and the memory, you're like, no, I know. I just know it's not.
Yeah. And I wouldn't, I mean, I think your process, unless you're somebody who was lucky enough to hit the ground running in terms of plotting, certainly, that's something I really felt my way doing blind in the dark. So I'm definitely not a pre-plotter. I layer and I layer and I layer, as we've established, starting with a scenario and then deciding what needs to precede it and then what needs to come after it. And so that's something that I think the main lesson I've learned is to spend a lot less time on the prose, because that's the that's the easy bit. The finding, I don't always find the right words, you know, every author, no matter who they are, they'll have some absolute honkers in their book. You know, always at the proofing stage, I'm kind of trying to eat my own elbow with cringiness at some phrase that's weaseled its way in there, or a word that turns up 9 times that's so weird that you think you would only use it once. But generally, that's what I find easy. So the words and kind of setting, if this doesn't make me sound like too much of an arsehole, I think of that last draft as setting the plot to music and really getting the descriptions bang on. Some of it sort of leaks out while I'm plotting and writing and drafting, but that's kind of the pudding at the end, or the treat.
So would you say, do you write quite lean in your first draft?
Well, increasingly so with every book. But I could never be somebody who bullet points it or sets it down in an Excel spreadsheet, because I also, to a degree, have to write my way in and get to know the characters. So I couldn't do a cold start. And just accepting, I'm just so much more ruthless now about killing my darlings. And I often find myself writing around and making the plot do these incredible gyrations and twists to accommodate one scene. And I'm learning now, get rid of that scene then, and then you're free. So thinking about what you gain when you delete rather than what you lose is a really helpful mindset, I think. And I'm finally there. It's only taken me 15 years.
15 years of bangers, though. The methodology was always good.
I've got a document on my... and thank you. But I've got a document on my computer called Appendix, and it's all of the cut chapters from everything. Not always polished, but... there's a good kind of 600,000 words there.
Oh my God, what a wild document.
Yeah, but because I've just tended to paste things on in any order, and just, you know what Microsoft Word's like, just wherever it lands, so probably it just looks like, I don't know, it's like on the road, it's just absolute, it's kind of a speed freak.
Alice's favourite bit. So yeah, I'm imagining, right, Romford, there'll be some town hall something, that Erin hit the scroll. You know, like Jack Kerouac's scroll toward the country. Let's just do it. 600K, all printed out in one go.
Like the Bayeux tapestry.
God. I'd rather die. That is one thing I am very still very precious about. I don't like sharing too much of my process. Apart from anything else, just because I write such stupid notes to myself in the margin. You know, come on, sort it out, Erin. Don't be a dick, you lazy fuck. That was one that I found when I was, I wrote "Turn the Internet Off" in capital letters in the middle of a draft once, and I was thinking, why is this one character? So, you know, they're not on. And then I was like, oh, it was a note to self. It was for me to stop myself pissing my life away on the internet.
That is a dangerous game, adding notes to yourself in your prose.
I know. Luckily, as well as being really sharp and professional, all my editors have had a really good sense of humour when they've come across these.
So what have you read recently that you would love to tell us, and by telling us you're also telling the friends of What Page Are You On about?
So I have recently read a book called Sarah Gran, who I hadn't read before but will read now, and that is such a treat to find a writer who's got a chunky backlist and you can just tear through. So it's called The Book of the Most Precious Substance, and actually I picked it up, like you, I'm very lucky and I get sent piles of books every week, and it's really easy for a book to be lost in that pile. But Sarah Hillary, my very good friend and very good writer, told me to pick up The Book of the Most Precious Substance by Sarah Gran, because it, a bit like The Skeleton Key, it's about a search for treasure, only in this case the treasure is a book. It's an occult manuscript said to be the most powerful occult book in the world that will bring to the owner whatever they desire if they perform a series of rituals, sexy rituals. And it's a bookseller who isn't particularly interested in the occult, but she is interested in selling books for money. And she searches for this book, teams up with a fellow bookseller, and comes very close to selling her soul. And with this fellow bookseller, she indulges the ritual, and it gets ruder and ruder every single time. And terrible things start happening and people who own the book start dying and it's all about to catch up with her. And it's just so, it's really meaty and it's a serious book and it's beautifully written. But it only took me a couple of days to read it. I mean, it's very, you know, there isn't a wasted word and the prose does a lot of heavy lifting and it's really spare, but it's also dark. But I do find some books that deal with the occult, they expect you to kind of have read 6 or 7 biographies of Aleister Crowley and, you know exactly what the Hellfire Club was. And I know a little bit about that, but this is a very welcoming introduction to that world. And I think it's a real skill to plunge the reader immediately deeply into that world and all the weird stuff that's happening, whoever you are. So, you know, if all you've read your entire life is Maeve Binchy, you can still wallop into this and within 3 chapters you know exactly where you are and you know the rules of this world, which I think is a real achievement.
I am so excited
for this.
It's
very you.
It's like coming out September, October, I think, isn't it?
It's early, I think, autumn. It's a little bit after mine, yes. Yeah, so I think
perfect.
October.
September, yeah.
Because we are fans of Come Closer, which is another Sarah Grahn.
Which I have just ordered.
You're going to love it.
You will love it. Such, yeah. I read it. I woke up at like 6 a.m. one morning and I was like, can I get back to sleep? And I'd just been sent a digital proof of it. So I was like, I'll give it a little go. I read it in like 2 hours. I came out of it like, where am I? What have I just experienced? It's so good.
And I feel like so many pod listeners have bought it and loved it as a result of us evangelizing about it. So that's nice. I like it when that happens.
Okay, well now they can go out and do it all over again.
Yeah.
The only thing I don't love is the title, just because it's a perfect title. It's a right old mouthful.
Yeah.
What is
the
Bush
title
of
again?
The Most Precious Substance?
Book.
Of the Most Precious Substance.
The
that's
book
what
of
it's called.
Yeah, it's quite a mouthful.
Which, I mean, you know, it's not exactly, I'm looking around now, something for like a single name. It's, yeah.
Driven by Kevin Eason.
It's not
for
exactly
example.
Driven by Kevin Eason.
Yeah,
is it?
Classic tome.
Or, you know, it's not Carrie, for example. It hasn't got that iconic feeling. But when you find out what the most precious substance is as well, that's a proper moment.
Well, we're very hyped to read it.
I can't wait. I cannot wait.
Well, I've had a lovely time.
Have you had a lovely time? I've had the best time.
I hope
what
our little friends at home have had a lovely time, because I feel like you've given us such juicy material. You've been so interesting. We have loved chatting to you, and I hope that has come through the airwaves.
So, The Skeleton Key is out on September the 1st. This episode, we have not decided when we're scheduling yet, so it may be out already, or it may be out next week.
Just check what the date is,
yeah,
when you're listening to this. You'll know. But yeah, thank you so much, Erin Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
Been a long time coming.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see you next time.
Bye!